Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with memoirist Sarah Capdeville, author of Aligning the Glacier's Ghost, Essays on Solitude and Landscape, an incredibly lyric collection of essays that cohere into a tender whole, giving readers and here our listeners a look into Sarah's experiences in nature, with chronic pain, and within queer communities. Sarah, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you so much for having me.
This collection is so much about place, so let's start there. I used to ask my guests what their relationship to the phrase American West was, what it meant to be from this particular place, this particular region. But lately, I've been asking a different question, and that is, what is your landscape of origin, and does it differ from your chosen landscape?
I love that question. I love that framing. I was born in Boulder, Colorado, and lived there for a year and a half, so I have very few memories of that place, but I think it's still, you know, that if we want to talk geographically, American West, Rocky Mountains region, and then grew up in Helena, which is on, you know, the east side of the Continental Divide, and then moved here for college. And I think I've been back and forth since, but primarily been living in Missoula since moving here for college. And just the difference in geography between kind of that east side of the divide versus the west side, the moisture, the terrain, the kinds of trees and plants and other ecology it feels vastly different. And I feel it feels cliche to say more at home here, but it just feels like the landscape is more, I feel more at ease here. Not to say that I don't feel at ease maybe in the landscape of around Helena, but that holds a certain sort of space and weight in terms of how I grew up. And this landscape of the Missoula area, the Rattlesnake, where a lot of this book is centered, it really feels like that place that I always have that pull back to.
I'm glad you mentioned home. I think that's a great segue into talking about one of the main themes in these essays. Will you talk about the way that you've approached ideas of home in this book and further how they intersect with desire?
So I moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania for my MFA program at Chatham University, which was a wonderful time, a wonderful program. And at the same time, the landscape was very, very different. And mm-hmm. I, a lot of times, did not feel that ease there. The horizon was very close. The, you know, just topography was very different from what I knew. The climate was different. And so I was homesick just about every day that I was living there. And I think that shows up in one way or another in this book. And I really think that it was that distance that allowed the perspective and the ability to reflect on home and sort of that idea of place and being able to write about this place with that strong connection. I don't know if I would have had the perspective to be able to come at it from that angle if I hadn't been away for an extended period of time and really started to see those contrasts, both in terms of landscape and also myself.
I'm curious, Sarah, you mentioned your body's ease in Montana, an ease that it didn't feel in Pittsburgh, that home meant an ease in your body. What then did your homesickness feel like?
It was very physical at times. I would say it was almost like a hunger, longing, that very body-centered feeling. And it was also a geographical pull. I remember looking at maps of Pittsburgh, and you have the Monongahela and the Allegheny Rivers meeting to form the Ohio, and they meet at a point that is pointing westward. And I remember just almost feeling like that was where I was getting tugged back to in that kind of like very physical way, corporeal way of, yeah, wanting to go back to the place that I feel most at ease.
I'm glad you used the word hunger, and I want to come back to that idea specifically, but I want to first talk about desire, which I will say is not unrelated to hunger either. You are a queer woman, and because this collection has so much to do with home and place, as we've been talking about, it also implicitly, and in some essays very explicitly, has to do with belonging. I'm going to ramble at you for just a minute, but I'm curious about the relationship between your queerness and your ecology. You write in one essay, the last essay, which centers autoimmunity and chronic pain, that, quote, autoimmunity works like this: the self and the other blur. And maybe, Sarah, I'm triangulating a little too much here, finding threads where you're not placing them, but this blurring of the self and the other, whether that other is nature or whether it's something foreign to the body or whether it's the body itself, that blurring feels like a queering. And because your coming out meant returning to your childhood home, I'm wondering if you've considered those intersections or how you've considered those intersections.
Absolutely. And I appreciate you picking up those threads. I like to drop many threads, and I appreciate when different readers take up different ones and highlight different sort of perspectives like that. And I'm glad you brought that up, because talking about ease and home and all of that, there is a lot of tension there too. And I think a lot of that for me in terms of growing up in Montana is centered around queerness, and that idea and that feeling of belonging was not really present for me in a lot of my growing up. And it wasn't until I started to travel more and spent time in Pittsburgh that really, like, I'd known that about myself. And it wasn't until those experiences and being surrounded by other queer people in a different environment, and I say environment very deliberately, that I was able to kind of ground myself more in that and hold on to that tension of these landscapes that do feel so important to me, where I have that ease, are also ones where I do feel unsafe sometimes, and that are unsafe for lots of queer and trans people now. And that, I think, is an important tension to hold. And it comes back to that piece of desire that you're referencing, and what does it mean to desire something that isn't in its current state attainable, while also recognizing that, yeah, landscapes and ecologies are constantly evolving and changing. And so what does it mean to put ourselves in a place where that change can happen personally, and then on the broader landscape level of culture and watching how that changes too?
We have been talking about desire and hunger. I want to ask you, and this might seem out of left field for our listeners, but maybe you can contextualize this question for them. What does Heinz ketchup have to do with wilderness?
Yeah, so I heard a story from one of my bosses at the Missoula Ranger District that there was a packer who, you know, did these trips into the Bob, and this was back in the day, and he, one trip, had some brothers from the East Coast who'd come out for kind of let's see what the West is like sort of adventure, and they, you know, came out and were on this packing trip deep into the wilderness with him, and this packer wanted to bring good food for these clients on his trips. And he had created this kind of squeeze bottle for ketchup. And so in this particular trip, the people from the East Coast, the brothers, were actually the Heinz brothers. The Heinz family is based out of Pittsburgh. And that's the ketchup brand. And they saw this guy with his squeeze bottle of ketchup and said, this is brilliant. And so they went back, and that's how the ketchup squeeze bottle, you know, came to be. And it, I don't know if there's a grain of truth in that. I actually know that the packer in the story is Smoke Elser. And so the timeline is, you know, much, much closer to current times. But I just loved the, I don't know, almost the magical quality of that story.
Sarah, maybe now is a good time to read from your collection. Would you mind reading a short excerpt from your final essay titled The Long View?
In July of 2017, a glint of lightning finds Dry Pines and takes to Lolo Peak. The fire begins about a mile west of the summit, and from there continues to sweep across ridges, wrapping around the mountain in a shawl of flame. Winds gust, shift, sweep embers high into the copper sky. The cinders land on the next bluff over, tearing into fir and lodgepole and old giants of white bark pine. The fire swarms higher, higher upslope, lapping into columned stands of subalpine larch. Flames reverse, spin, and tumble downslope. On its eastern side, the fire eyes the Bitter River and closes the highway, and on its southern flank, it paces the edges of Lolo Creek. Pilot cars lead traffic into the walls of smoke, high beams dimmed to a child's nightlight, the whole surrounding world shut in sepia. Two homes burn down in the fire. 3,000 people are evacuated, told to grab what they can and leave. Sheriff's deputies weave up ponderosa pillared drives, knock on front doors until someone opens. They have to leave. This is no disaster to wait out. There's no easy answer when it comes to wildfire in the West. Remember, nature is messy. Nature feeds on entropy, continual chaos, disturbances like wind and flame and flood to stack baselines back into an ecosystem. Lodgepole pine have serotonous cones sealed in resin that will only open after the parent has burned to a charcoal skeleton. Larch layer bark thick enough to insulate their living rings from the flames, all while depending on the fire to scorch a clean slate for seedlings below. Slopes are charred to black dust one year, then splashed with willow and fireweed and alder the next. Elk herds flock and grow fat on the green. Which is to say, there's no one reason the Lolo Peak fire sprawled across almost 54,000 acres, consumed three homes, took one human life, a firefighter trying to beat back the spread. The white bark pines have held their branches high for hundreds of years, waiting for that lightning strike. The subalpine larch kept their tough skins. The lodgepole pine crowded thick above self-pruning Doug firs. Some of their cones opened to a dim understory. Some stayed closed like a wax seal on a love letter. Decade by decade, small fires were put out. The fuel load grew and grew. We learn that fire is bad. We learn that trees are timber, a product grown and harvested under the Department of Agriculture. We learn a black bear cub stumbled onto a fire line in New Mexico with blistered paws. We learn to protect forest without listening to the white bark, the lodgepole, the longleaf pine, the black-backed woodpeckers. We learn we're not as powerful as we think, so we turn the other way, build another watchtower.
I think there are a number of ways we could talk about that excerpt, but I want to focus on a phrase, we turn the other way. I was reminded while you were reading, in this moment, in this essay, of another moment at the beginning of the book when you write about Schrodinger's cat. You write, quote, I think of the times I've broken or dropped or otherwise altered something, a bowl on the kitchen floor, a folder of organized files, an ankle popping under my weight, and looked away as though that would change the outcome, as if the outcome could stay suspended, unknown, unmarked, until I had the capacity to bear witness. You also write about multiple moments wherein you dread being observed and terrified of inquiry. Sarah, this collection, put simply for our listeners, is about your growth alongside landscapes that have nourished you, right? And I'm wondering, whether writing, the act of writing, and writing these essays in particular, has proven that growth, that it has become the way you refuse to look away, the way you've grown more at ease, as we've been talking about, under observation, even your own observation.
Thank you. I really appreciate that framing and the tying between those two essays, going back to the starting essay and that idea of bearing witness. I think that really became a central sort of foothold for me in the collection, and this idea of how do I bear witness? How do the collective we bear witness? And it's a really difficult question, I think, in the context of climate change, especially in watching these landscapes change. And I think it's also important in the context of narrative. And so in this passage that I read, I'm thinking about how the idea of Smokey the Bear, you know, only you can prevent wildfires. And this is a narrative that we all know. Smokey Bear is still around. And yet fire is so much more complex than one horrible bad thing on a landscape. It can be, and it can also be very nourishing. And so having room for that complexity, I think, is very important. And then if, you know, we dig deeper and we look into the history of timber harvest in the West and across these landscapes, that is just, yeah, if we think about the history of timber harvesting, mining, all these kind of colonial practices that have just really harmed the landscape and the people here, there's, I think, complicity in turning away from that impact and seeing how that impact continues today. And so I think in this collection, I was talking actually to my mom recently and saying, you know, a lot of the stuff in this book is maybe, it's hard to read, it's personal, it's intimate, especially for a parent. And I was telling her, you know, it's in this book because I've processed it, that it being here is a way that I have been able to release it in that way. And so I really think that the idea of bearing witness, I have borne witness to what is in this book in a way that has allowed me that growth, at least, and to move on to whatever the next thing it is to bear witness to.
Let's talk briefly about your parents' reactions, Sarah. Your mom, you said it was difficult for her to read these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely, both of my parents, just because I think it's hard to read about your kid going through hard things. But when I told her that, I think it was a bit of a release for her to say, you know, me putting these words on the page, there's so much that I did in the background to get me to the point of being able to make these connections even, whereas before going through it just felt raw and painful and confusing and messy. And that is part of it too. Part of the bearing witness is just being stuck in what's really painful. And sometimes you're always stuck in what's painful. Sometimes you're in and out. But I think for this particular collection, looking back on it now, so the kind of framing of it, it feels like a different period in my life. And that was actually something that was holding me back for a while of thinking about publishing it or even putting these essays together into something, because it was really painful to go back in kind of an editorial sense to some of these experiences, sort of step back and say, okay, this is who I was, and I'm ready to move forward and do that growth.
You're listening to A Conversation with essayist Sarah Capdeville. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Fact and Fiction Books, an independent bookstore located in the heart of downtown Missoula, Montana, providing books for all ages and supporting the literary community in Montana and beyond. More information can be found at factandfictionbooks.com. So if these essays are not only a record, but a processing of your life and its changes, I'm curious about, I guess, when you came to it in that way. When did you begin writing what are ultimately very beautiful, very lyric essays, these essays that you've collected here? When did that impulse to process through your writing begin for you?
You know, I'd say it actually started when I was in undergrad here at the University of Montana. I was lucky enough to take a nonfiction nature writing class with Phil Condon.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. In the environmental studies program. And I had always loved reading. I'd always loved writing. And it never, I don't think it never, it had never occurred to me until that class that what I loved most about reading and writing, that narrative piece, that storytelling, could fit into both nonfiction and also like writing about the environment. I'd never kind of, it hadn't clicked in the same way for me before. And after that class, I really started to realize like, okay, this is, I already know this is how I process the world, of pulling those threads together, of, you know, seeing the poetry of how those stories pull together. And, you know, there is a vast genre for that. And so I really think it was that final semester here at the University of Montana when that clicked for me of, oh, this is how I can process my experiences and write about them in a way that feels authentic to my own voice.
I'd like to round out our conversation with one more excerpt from The Long View again, from that final section. Would you mind reading that final section, Sarah?
Yeah. Once this place knew glaciers. The day after I thought my heart was going to stop itself, I sit for 12 hours on the hood of a Forest Service pickup, turning back joggers and mountain bikers as they reach the Bees Cove fire closure. Every so often, a string of hotshot buggies or fire rigs come rolling through, turning sepia dust into the slatted limbs of ponderosa and fir. Otherwise, the hours are long and quiet. There's no smudge of smoke to be seen. Sea jade algae flourish in fungi's elbows. A parade of ants steers clear of lingering diesel fumes. The Ranger District picked this spot for the closure because it's the branching point of various trails, a solid stopping point, 3 miles from the trailhead and another 3 from the fire itself. But there's a grandness here, too. The ants, I'm sure, know it, as do the lichen, the pines, the dark-eyed juncos, the lupine. Epochs banded in silt and clay beyond where the wind can reach, glints of quartz like starlight. Glaciers shaped the valleys of the Rattlesnake Mountains during the last ice age. They left behind cirques, hanging, and U-shaped valleys, including the main drainage of Rattlesnake Creek, which gathers itself in the shelved woods below the wilderness's highest peak and drapes downslope like a fishhook. A millennia ago, it was only a cropped ravine, a fissure where ice pried with fingers of hoarfrost. The glacial tongue grew fat on long winters and followed the oldest rule of gravity. Like a bear to a grubbed log, it dug headfirst into the earth, breaking horizons free of their planes. Humus churned to bedrock, obsidian-glossed fossils reintroduced to the cold and oxygenated air. Season after season, the glacier slipped from high-hanging lofts down its self-made passage. Then, having plowed a rim of sediment 200 feet high at its front, it stopped and warmed and melted to the nurseries of bull trout. I spend all day perched at the base of the glacial moraine terminus without giving it much thought. The sun's passage through bunches of pine needles feels long enough, and there's a weight still gnawing at my chest fit to align itself with the glacier's ghost. This is before all the serious tests, before I wheeze my lungs' atmosphere into a glass chamber, before I watch the valves of my heart float open and shut on an ultrasound monitor. I return to work because my heart's still thumping, since that seems to be the black and white point of decision. A moment of free fall, of stubbornness. Autoimmunity works like this. The self and the other blur. A sturdy branch of lung tissue turns to a knotted virus. A forest of villi clear cut from the inside, beetles thick as sable blood. A bear, hungry with her promised winter, moves through the morning crepuscular. Take the long view, windstruck on a summit and exposed to every direction. We forget the land has horizons that have nothing to do with hope. Here is a story, one thread on top of another, ash of the oldest trees and bones of a free-roaming bison, poison and fencing and flagpoles and oil. All those words of possession and salvation. I've panned for silver linings and found only chaos, wept these questions whose meanings start quick and brief as hummingbirds. How can you hate a broken body? Shout through the thinnest air of the alpine, and the echo returns cuffed by snow and white bark pitch, the same way you can hate a broken world. Maybe it wasn't grief that tumbled me over, but the shock of all that beauty as it calved to disconnect. I'm not buried yet. Maybe there is strength in the mess, not how my lungs once rushed like Chinook winds, but the way this absence hangs between my ribs, a moraine that didn't slough away, a glacier gone, a quiet fire in its place.
So our listeners now know where the title of your essay collection comes from, Aligning the Glacier's Ghost. It's such a beautiful title. It's such a rich title. But I loved another line in this excerpt, in this essay. Quote, "We forget that the land has horizons that have nothing to do with hope." I will say, Sarah, that this collection is pragmatic. It is not romanticized, or maybe the craft of it is. The writing is lyrical, the writing is romantic, but the themes and the content, perhaps the outlook, is not romanticized. But I'm wondering, is it hopeful? Are you hopeful, Sarah?
Oh, what a question in these times.
Yeah.
I do appreciate you saying that about kind of it being pragmatic and the outlooks maybe not being as romantic, because I think I have a tendency in myself to romanticize landscapes and those connections. And sometimes I feel like as I'm drawing these threads together, as I'm pulling narratives together, it's like, oh, are these too close? Am I just shoving things together in a very pretty rose-colored sort of tapestry? I think I have hope in the way that hope is an action, is a practice, is a way of being in the world. And I think that's part of what that line is, that there are horizons that have nothing to do with hope. In this particular passage, I'm talking about, you know, horizons of soil and bedrock in the landscape, which is layers and layers of sediment, of rock, of stone, of organisms that have lived in the past. And those are stories in themselves. And I think that there's so much to learn from what has already happened and how it is both replicating and not being replicated going forward. Yeah, those stories being replicated, it's cliche to say, but that's, you know, how we learn to do better or do differently or follow patterns. That's how knowledge gets passed along. And so I think to see that hope as something that's grounded in a way, it feels more tangible to me, even as things feel very scary.
That was Sarah Capdeville, author of Aligning the Glacier's Ghost, Essays on Solitude and Landscape, out now from University of New Mexico Press. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Sarah, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.